in drawing a parallel between human parents and harmoniums, refers to the dealings of Unc and Boaz with harmoniums. The harmoniums spelled out for Unc and Boaz a new message of hope or veiled derision every 14 earthling days, for 3 years. The messages were written, of course, by Winston Niles Rumford, who materialized briefly on Mercury at 14-day intervals. He peeled off harmoniums here, slapped others up there, making the block letters. In Mrs. Canby's tale, the first intimation given that Rumford is around the caves from time to time is given in a scene very close to the end, a scene wherein Unc finds the tracks of a big dog in the dust. At this point in the story, it is mandatory, if an adult is reading the story aloud to a child, for the adult to ask the child with delicious hoarseness,
"Who was a dog?"
Dog was a Cossack. Dog was a Winston Niles Rumford's great, big, mean, chronosynclastic, infandibulated dog. Unc and Boaz had been on Mercury for 3 earthling years when Unc found Kazakh's footprints in the dust on the floor of a cave corridor. Mercury had carried Unc and Boaz 12.5 times around the sun. Unc found the prints on the floor 6 miles above the chamber in which the dented, scarred, and rock-bound spaceship lay. Unc didn't live in the spaceship anymore, and neither did Boaz. The spaceship served merely as a common supply base to which Unc and Boaz returned for provisions once every earthling month or so. Unc and Boaz rarely met. They moved in very different circles. The circles in which Boaz moved were small. His abode was fixed and richly furnished. It was on the same level as the spaceship, only 1/4 mile away from it. The circles in which Unc moved were vast and restless. He had no home. He traveled light, and he traveled far, climbing ever higher until he was stopped by cold. Where the cold stopped Unc, the cold stopped the harmoniums, too. On the upper levels where Unc wandered, the harmoniums were stunted and few. On the cozy lower level where Boaz lived, the harmoniums were plentiful and fast-growing. Boaz and Unc had separated after 1 earthling year together in the spaceship. In that first year together, it had become clear to both of them that they weren't going to get out unless something or somebody came and got them out. That had been clear, even though the creatures on the walls continued to spell out the messages emphasizing the fairness of the test to which Unc and Boaz were being subjected, the ease with which they might escape, if only they would think a little harder, if they would only think a little more intricately. "Think!" the creatures would say. Unc and Boaz separated after Unc went temporarily insane. He had tried to murder Boaz. Boaz had come into the spaceship with a harmonium, which was exactly like all the other harmoniums, and he'd said, "Ain't he a cute little feller, Unc?" Unc had gone for Boaz's throat. Unc was naked when he found the dog tracks. The lichen-green uniform and the black fiber boots of the Martian assault infantry had been scoured to threads and dust by the touch of stone. The dog tracks did not excite Unc. Unc's soul wasn't filled with the music of sociability or the light of hope when he saw a warm-blooded creature's tracks, saw the tracks of man's best friend. And he still had very little to say to himself when the tracks of a well-shod man joined those of the dog. Unc was at war with his environment. He had come to regard his environment as being either malevolent or cruelly mismanaged. His response was to fight it with the only weapons at hand, passive resistance and open displays of contempt. The footprints seemed to Unc to be the opening moves in one more fat-headed game his environment wanted to play. He would follow the tracks, but lazily, without excitement. He would follow them simply because he had nothing else scheduled for the time. He would follow them. He would see where they went. His progress was knobby and ramshackle. Poor Unc had lost a lot of weight, and a lot of hair, too. He was aging fast. His eyes felt hot, and his skeleton felt rickety. Unc never shaved on Mercury. When his hair and beard got so long as to be a bother, he would hack away wads of thatch with a butcher knife. Boaz shaved every day. Boaz gave himself a haircut twice an earthling week with a barber kit from the spaceship. Boaz, 12 years younger than Ankh, had never felt better in his life. He had gained weight in the caves of Mercury, and serenity, too. Boaz's home vault was furnished with a cot, a table, 2 chairs, a punching bag, a mirror, dumbbells, a tape recorder, and a library of recorded music on tape consisting of 1,100 compositions. Boaz's home vault had a door on it, a round boulder with which he could plug the vault's mouth. The door was necessary, since Boaz was God Almighty to the Harmoniums. They could locate him by his heartbeat. Had he slept with his door open, he would have awakened to find himself pinned down by hundreds of thousands of his admirers. They would have let him up only when his heartbeat stopped beating. Boaz, like Ankh, was naked. But he still had shoes. His genuine leather shoes had held up gorgeously. True, Ankh had walked 50 miles to every mile walked by Boaz, but Boaz's shoes had not merely held up. They looked as good as new. Boaz wiped, waxed, and shined them regularly. He was shining them now. The door of his vault was blocked by the boulder. Only 4 favored harmoniums were inside with him. 2 were wrapped about his upper arms. 1 was stuck to his thigh. The 4th, an immature harmonium only 3 inches long, clung to the inside of his left wrist, feeding on Boaz's pulse. When Boaz found a harmonium he loved more than all the rest, that was what he did, let the creature feed on his pulse. "You like that?" he said in his thoughts to the lucky harmonium. "Ain't that nice?" He had never felt better physically, had never felt better mentally, had never felt better spiritually. He was glad he and Ankh had separated, because Ankh liked to twist things around to where it seemed that anybody who was happy was dumb or crazy. "What makes a man be like that?" Boaz asked the little harmonium in his thoughts. "What's he think he's gaining compared to what he's throwing away? No wonder he looks sick." Boaz shook his head. "I keep trying to interest him in you fellers, and he just got madder. Never helps to get mad." "I don't know what's going on," said Boaz in his thoughts. "And I'm probably not smart enough to understand if somebody was to explain it to me. All I know is we're being tested somehow, by somebody or something a whole lot smarter than us. And all I can do is be friendly and keep calm and try and have a nice time till it's over." Boaz nodded. "That's my philosophy, friends," he said to the harmonium stuck to him. "And if I'm not mistaken, that's yours too. I reckon that's how come we hit it off so good." The genuine leather toe of the shoe that Boaz was shining glowed like a ruby. "Men? Oh, now. Men, men, men," said Boaz to himself, staring into the ruby. When he shined his shoes, he imagined that he could see many things in the rubies of the toes. Right now, Boaz was looking into a ruby and seeing Ankh strangling poor old Stony Stevenson at the stone stake on the iron parade ground back on Mars. The horrible image wasn't a random recollection. It was dead center in Boaz's relationship with Ankh. "Don't truth me," said Boaz in his thoughts, "and I won't truth you." It was a plea he had made several times to Ankh. Boaz had invented the plea, and its meaning was this. Ankh was to stop telling Boaz truths about the harmoniums, because Boaz loved the harmoniums, and because Boaz was nice enough not to bring up truths that would make Ankh unhappy. Ankh didn't know that he had strangled his friend, Stony Stevenson. Ankh thought Stony was still marvelously alive somewhere in the universe. Ankh was living on dreams of a reunion with Stony. Boaz was nice enough to withhold the truth from Ankh, no matter how great the provocation had been to club Ankh between the eyes with it. The horrible image in the ruby dissolved. "Yes, Lord," said Boaz in his thoughts. The adult harmonium on Boaz's upper left arm stirred.
You asking old Boaz for a concert?
Boaz asked the creature in his thoughts.
That what you trying to say? You trying to say, old Boaz, I don't want to sound ungrateful on account of I know it's a great honor to get to be right here close to your heart. Only I keep thinking about all my friends outside, and I keep wishing they could have something good too. That what you trying to say?
Said Boaz in his thoughts.
You trying to say, please, Papa Boaz, put on a concert for all the poor friends outside. That what you trying to say?
Boaz smiled.
You don't have to flatter me, he said to the harmonium.
The small harmonium on his wrist doubled up, extended itself again.
What you trying to tell me?
He asked it.
You trying to say, Uncle Boaz, your pulse is just too rich for a little tad like me. Uncle Boaz, please just play some nice, sweet, easy music to eat. That what you trying to say?
Boaz turned his attention to the harmonium on his right arm. The creature had not moved.
Ain't you the quiet one, though?
Boaz asked the creature in his thoughts.
Don't say much, but thinking all the time. I guess you're thinking old Boaz is pretty mean not just letting the music play all the time, huh?
The harmonium on his left arm stirred again.
What's that you say?
Said Boaz in his thoughts. He cocked his head, pretending to listen, though no sounds could travel through the vacuum in which he lived.
You say, please, King Boaz, play us the 1812 overture?
Boaz looked shocked, then stern.
Just because something feels better than anything else, he said in his thoughts, that don't mean it's good for you.
Scholars whose field is the Martian War often exclaim over the queer unevenness of Rumford's war preparations. In some areas, his plans were horribly flimsy. The shoes he issued his ordinary troops, for instance, were almost a satire on the temporariness of the jerry-built society of Mars, on a society whose whole purpose was to destroy itself in uniting the peoples of Earth. In the music libraries Rumford personally selected for the company motherships, however, one sees a great cultural nest egg, a nest egg prepared as though for a monumental civilization that was going to endure for 1,000 earthling years. It is said that Rumford spent more time on the useless music libraries than he did on artillery and field sanitation combined. As an anonymous wit has it, the Army of Mars arrived with 300 hours of continuous music and didn't last long enough to hear the minute waltz to the end. The explanation of the bizarre emphasis on the music carried by the Martian motherships is simple. Rumford was crazy about good music. A craze, incidentally, that struck him only after he had been spread through time and space by the chronosynclastic infundibulum. The harmoniums in the caves of Mercury were crazy about good music, too. They had been feeding on one sustained note in the Song of Mercury for centuries. When Boaz gave them their first taste of music, which happened to be Le Sac du Printemps, some of the creatures actually died in ecstasy. A dead harmonium is shriveled and orange in the yellow light of the mercurial caves. A dead harmonium looks like a dried apricot. On that first occasion, which hadn't been planned as a concert for the harmoniums, the tape recorder had been on the floor of the spaceship. The creatures who had actually died in ecstasy had been in direct contact with the metal hull of the ship. Now, 2.5 years later, Boaz demonstrated the proper way to stage a concert for the creatures so as not to kill them. Boaz left his home vault, carrying the tape recorder and the musical selections for the concert with him. In the corridor outside were two aluminum ironing boards. These had fiber pads on their feet. The ironing boards were 6 feet apart, and spanning them was a stretcher made of aluminum poles and lichen fiber canvas. Boaz placed the tape recorder in the middle of the stretcher. The purpose of the engine resulting was to dilute and dilute and dilute the vibrations from the tape recorder. The vibrations, before they reached the stone floor, had to struggle through the dead canvas of the stretcher, down the stretcher handles, through the ironing boards, and finally through the fiber pads on the feet of the ironing boards. The dilution was a safety measure. It guaranteed that no harmonium would get a lethal overdose of music. Boaz now put the tape in the recorder and turned the recorder on. Throughout the concert, he would stand guard by the apparatus. His duty was to see that no creature crept too close to the apparatus. His duty, when a creature crept too close, was to peel the creature from the wall or floor, scold it, and paste it up again 100 yards or more away.
"If you ain't got no more sense than that,"
he would say in his thoughts to the foolhardy harmonium,
"you're going to wind up out here in left field every time. Think it over."
Actually, a creature placed 100 yards from the tape recorder still got plenty of music to eat. The walls of the caves were so extraordinarily conductive, in fact, that the harmoniums on the cave walls miles away got whiffs of Boaz's concerts through the stone. Unc, who had been following the tracks deeper and deeper into the caves, could tell from the way the harmoniums were behaving that Boaz was staging a concert. He had reached a warm level where the harmoniums were thick. Their regular pattern of alternating yellow and aquamarine diamonds was breaking up, was degenerating into jagged clumps, pinwheels, and lightning bolts. The music was making them do it. Unc laid his pack down, then laid himself down to rest. Unc dreamed about colors other than yellow and aquamarine. Then he dreamed that his good friend Stony Stevenson was waiting for him around the next bend. His mind became lively with the things he and Stony would say when they met. Unc's mind still had no face to go with the name of Stony Stevenson, but that didn't matter much. "What a pair," Unc said to himself. By that, he meant that he and Stony, working together, would be invincible. "I tell you," Unc said to himself with satisfaction, "that is one pair they want to keep apart at all costs. If old Stony and old Unc ever get together again, they better watch out. When old Stony and old Unc get together, anything can happen. And it usually does." Old Unc chuckled. The people who were supposedly afraid of Unc's and Stony's getting together were the people in the big, beautiful buildings up above. Unc's imagination had done a lot in 3 years with the glimpses he'd had of the supposed buildings, of what were in fact solid, dead, dumb, cold crystals. Unc's imagination was now certain that the masters of all creation lived in those buildings. They were Unc's and Boaz's and maybe Stony's jailers. They were experimenting with Unc and Boaz in the caves. They wrote the messages in harmoniums. The harmoniums didn't have anything to do with the messages. Unc knew all those things for sure. Unc knew a lot of other things for sure. He even knew how the buildings up above were furnished. The furniture didn't have any legs on it. It just floated in air, suspended by magnetism. And the people never worked at all, and they never worried about a thing. Unc hated them. He hated the harmoniums, too. He peeled a harmonium from the wall and tore it in two. It shriveled at once, turned orange. Unc flipped the two-piece corpse at the ceiling, and, looking up at the ceiling, he saw a new message written there. The message was disintegrating because of the music, but it was still legible. The message told Unc in 5 words how to escape surely, easily, and swiftly from the caves. He was bound to admit, when given the solution to the puzzle that he had failed to solve in 3 years, that the puzzle was simple and fair. Unc scuttled down through the caves until he came upon Boaz's concert for the harmoniums. Unc was wild and bug-eyed with big news. He could not speak in a vacuum, so he hauled Boaz to the spaceship. There, in the inert atmosphere of the cabin, Unc told Boaz of the message that meant escape from the caves. It was now Boaz's turn to react numbly. Boaz had thrilled to the slightest illusion of intelligence on the part of the harmoniums, But now, having heard the news that he was about to be freed from his prison, Boaz was strangely reserved.
That explains the other message,
said Boaz softly. What other message? Asked Unc. Boaz held up his hands to represent a message that had appeared on the wall outside his home 4 earthling days before.
Said, Boaz, don't go,
said Boaz. He looked down self-consciously.
We love you, Boaz. That's what it said.
Boaz dropped his hands to his side, turned away as though turning away from unbearable beauty.
I saw that, he said, and I had to smile. I looked at them sweet, gentle fellers on the wall there, and I says to myself, boys, how's old Boaz ever going to go anywhere? Old Boaz, he going to be stuck here for quite some time yet.
It's a trap, said Unc.
It's a what?
Said Boaz. A trap, said Unc. A trick to keep us here. The comic book called Tweety and Sylvester was open on the table before Boaz. Boaz didn't answer Unc right away. He leaped through the ragged book instead.
I expect, he said at last.
Unc thought about the crazy appeal in the name of love. He did something that he hadn't done for a long time. He laughed. He thought it was an hysterical ending for the nightmare, that the brainless membranes on the walls should speak of love. Boaz suddenly grabbed Unc, rattled poor Unc's dry bones.
I'd appreciate it, Unc, said Boaz tautly, if you'd just let me think whatever I'm going to think about that message, about how they love me. I mean, he said, you know, he said, it don't necessarily have to make sense to you. I mean, he said, you know, he said, there ain't really any call for you to say anything about it, one way or the other, I mean, he said. You know, he said, these animals ain't necessarily your dish. You don't necessarily have to like them, or understand them, or say anything about them, I mean, said Boaz. You know, said Boaz, the message wasn't addressed to you. It's me they said they loved. That lets you out.
He let Unc go, turned attention to the comic book again. His broad, brown, slab-muscled back amazed Unc. Living apart from Boaz, Unc had flattered himself into thinking he was a physical match for Boaz. He saw now what a pathetic delusion this had been. The muscles in Boaz's back slid over one another in slow patterns that were counterpoint to the quick movements of his page-turning fingers.
You know so much about traps and things, said Boaz. How you know there ain't some worse trap waiting for us if we go flying out of here?
Before Unc could answer him, Boaz remembered that he had left the tape recorder playing unguarded.
Ain't nobody watching out for him at all, he cried.
He left Unc, ran to rescue the harmoniums. While Boaz was gone, Unc made plans for turning the spaceship upside down. That was the solution to the puzzle of how to get out. That was what the harmoniums on the ceiling had said. Unc, turn ship upside down. The theory of turning the spaceship over was sound, of course. The ship's sensing equipment was on its bottom. When turned over, the ship would be able to apply the same easy grace and intelligence to getting out of the caves that it had used getting into them. Thanks to a power winch and the feeble tug of gravity in the caves of Mercury, Unc had the ship turned over by the time Boaz got back. All that remained to be done for the trip out was to press the on button. The upside-down ship would then blunder against the cave floor, give up, retreat from the floor under the impression that the floor was a ceiling. It would go up the system of chimneys under the impression that it was going down. And it would inevitably find the way out, under the impression that it was seeking the deepest possible hole. The hole it would eventually find itself in would be the bottomless, sideless pit of space eternal. Boaz came into the upside-down ship, his arms loaded with dead harmoniums. he was carrying 4 quarts or more of the seeming dried apricots. Inevitably, he dropped some, and, in stooping to pick them up reverently, he dropped more. Tears were streaming down his face.
"You see?"
said Boaz. He was raging heartbrokenly against himself.
"You see, Unc?"
he said.
"See what happens when somebody just runs off and forgets?"
Boaz shook his head.
"This ain't all of them,"
he said.
"This ain't near all of them."
He found an empty carton that had once contained candy bars. He put the harmonium corpses into that. He straightened up, his hands on his hips. Just as Unc had been amazed by Boaz's physical condition, so was Unc now amazed by Boaz's dignity. Boaz, when he straightened up, was a wise, decent, weeping, brown Hercules. Unc, by comparison, felt scrawny, rootless, and sore-headed.
"You want to do the dividing, Unc?"
said Boaz. "Dividing?" said Unc.
"Goofballs, food, soda pop, candy,"
said Boaz. "Divide it all?" said Unc. "My God, there's enough of everything for 500 years. There had never been any talk of dividing things before. There had been no shortage, and no threat of a shortage of anything.
"Half for you to take with you, and half to leave here with me,"
said Boaz. "Leave with you?" said Unc incredulously. You're coming with me, aren't you?" Boaz held up his big right hand, and it was a tender gesture for silence, a gesture made by a thoroughly great human being.
"Don't truth me, Unc," said Boaz. "And I won't truth you."
He brushed away his tears with a fist. Unc had never been able to brush aside the plea about truthing. It frightened him. Some part of his mind warned him that Boaz was not bluffing, that Boaz really knew a truth about Unc that could tear him to pieces. Unc opened his mouth and closed it again.